Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Another Oval Office speech, this time about war. What does it mean this time? Joining us today is Sean Kay. He's a professor of politics at Ohio Wesleyan University and an associate of the Mershon Center for International Security Studies at The Ohio State University. He is author of Global Security in the 21st Century, The Quest for Power and the Search for Peace. And as a NATO expert in 2007 and 2008, Sean was a foreign policy advisor to the Obama presidential campaign. This summer, he was in Ireland working on a book. Sean, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Lots to talk about today. Iraq, Afghanistan, and Ireland. So we'll get started with Iraq. I guess it was in the news. And let's hear from the president right now.
So tonight, I am announcing that the American combat mission in Iraq has ended. Operation Iraqi Freedom is over, and the Iraqi people now have lead responsibility for the security of their country.
But are they free? Mm-hmm. And did we win the war in Iraq?
Are they free? Well, the Iraqi people are certainly liberated from the government of Saddam Hussein, although as one Iraqi I heard last night comment on television, now we have 1,000 different Saddams at a local level. So that's a little unclear. Did we win the war? Well, first of all, really quickly on the president's point, yes, it's true. We've changed the name of the mission. We've drawn down standalone combat forces, but the troops that are still there continue to be at risk. They will be engaged in combat. So the public needs to understand that in fact, in many respects, we're entering as dangerous a phase in the ongoing war in Iraq that we've seen in some time. So that's one answer to the question, did we win the war? Top experts on Iraq would tell you we can't even begin to get metrics on that probably until about 2020, for about another decade or so. Winning a war, it depends on what your objectives were. Did we topple Saddam Hussein? Sure. Did we build a democracy? It's better now than it was. Did we find weapons of mass destruction? No, because they weren't there. Was there a link between Iraq and al-Qaeda? No. I would measure that question in terms of, did the war in Iraq increase or decrease American national security? And I think by any reasonable standard, it was a substantial net loss for American power in the world, American prestige in the world, our ability to use coalition leadership, military capabilities, the relative costs, which estimates show will run as high as $3 trillion before this is all done, the distraction away from Afghanistan, Abu Ghraib prison, the impact on our troops, the long-term psychological and physical impact on those who've been wounded, the dead Iraqis. It's the relative standing of America in the world has been significantly damaged by this war. We're doing a little better now, but the war has left a deep scar, I think, in American society. And I think that that's in terms of the cohesion, if you think what we had after 9/11 versus what this war ended up doing to our domestic sort of psyche, it's going to take a long time to get past that. So the idea, as the president said last night, that we need to turn the page on this war, that's somewhat problematic because this war is still going on.
My guest is Sean Kay. He's a professor at Ohio Wesleyan University. He is an international relations and also an associate at the OSU Mershon Center for International Security Studies. What do Iraqis think of the withdrawal? Is just business as usual for them, just as it is for the 50,000 troops that are left there now?
All I can measure is what the same kind of things average people would see, for man on the street interviews. There are public opinion polls and so forth, and I think that there is a general sense that things are better now than they were. But on the other hand, especially in Baghdad, not anywhere near where people would like to be in terms of just personal safety. Average killings per month, BBC reported this morning, have gone down to quite a bit. I mean, a dramatic drop in just day-to-day violence in Iraq. So for average people, that's better. But got to remember, the purpose of the surge was to provide stability for the Iraqi people so that they could begin taking responsibility for their own future, so that they would have political reconciliation, so that they would have revenue sharing over oil, so that we would have regional diplomacy. None of those three things have happened yet. They didn't happen under President Bush, and they're still not happening yet now today. That was part of the purpose of sending more troops in the first place. That was a tactic intended to establish a periphery, an architecture, so Iraqi people could take responsibility for their own future. So the question there is, are things better for them today than they were 3 or 4 years ago? Sure. Are they ready for this transition? I don't think we really know the answer to that, and I don't think we'll know it for some time.
Can we read anything into the fact that President Obama mentioned that he had consulted or talked with former President Bush about all of this before the speech last night?
I thought about that. I find it hard to read into it because we don't know what they talked about.
Right.
He didn't relay what
he
actually
told us. I'm not as surprised that he talked to him as much as he made a point of telling the Americans.
I would read that in the sense of trying to make an effort to begin to bring the country together a bit on the differences that happened over this war. For example, he had a line in his speech where he said there were patriots that were for this war and patriots that were against this war. So I think in that sense he's trying to bridge that gap between his own initial opposition to it and his opposition to the surge in 2006, 2007, and George Bush's steadfast commitment to see this war through, to stay the course, and to put that in a new framework so that at least Americans might begin to, I think in his hope, to reconcile some of these differences and move the country forward. And the critical pivot point there was back onto economic issues.
Right.
And by the way, he did then add that over the last 10 years, we've also done pretty bad on that front.
Well, he did. The basic premise for getting into the war in the first place, the weapons of mass destruction, that still bothers a lot of Americans, patriots, as he's pointed out. People are very frustrated by that. And I don't know if they want what you can do to appease that, but by ignoring it?
Yeah, I think that that's the part that worries me about the speech. You can't just turn the page as simply as the president would like to see happen here. And I know he knows that well, but he's also been pretty willing to, for example, not look into allegations of abuse with regards to interrogations and things that went on before, wanting to move forward rather than look back. I do understand that. But on the other hand, a lot really bad went on during this war. And you can't just ignore that, because if you turn the page too quickly, you run the risk of saying a lot of nice things about supporting our veterans, for example. But are you really going to invest the resources that are necessary when it comes down to the budget? What are you going to do in terms of recapitalizing, re-equipping, rebuilding the U.S. military, which has been really strained with regard to this? And what do you do about the ongoing war in Afghanistan? So, that war is more difficult today because of the war in Iraq, relative to resources, public support. The majority of the American public does not support the war in Afghanistan anymore. That's a sea change. So this war in Iraq has had a major impact on America's place in the world, on our capabilities to exert ourselves in the world, and our budget, our economy. It's part of our economic foundations of power, the damage that this war did. So we can't just turn the page. But on the weapons of mass destruction is particularly important because, I remember being on a conference, a briefing before the president spoke to West Point. It was a White House briefing for interested people. And they said, well, the intelligence is showing us A, B, C, or D about Afghanistan. And I kept thinking, well, wait a minute. We're just supposed to take that. Okay, now you're saying it, so it means it's okay. Unless we really dig in and look openly and transparently at what happened in the use of intelligence that went up to the war, which we really still haven't done.
And they have been doing it in Great Britain.
Yeah, in Britain they have. They have a commission that's ongoing. They brought Tony Blair in to testify on the record under oath and so forth. They are having a commission. And until you can really – I mean, we've had studies. We've had reports and so forth. And there's a lot of good information that average people can get. PBS has an excellent site on Frontline where you can go read transcripts of interviews with the key players that were involved. But that said, it really hasn't been looked into. For example, the Senate – had relatively scant amount of hearings into just what happened at Abu Ghraib prison. We haven't had, with the Democrats in charge, a willingness to really go back and look at what happened here. And unless you can get those parts of the historic piece of the puzzle right, then there is always that risk, no matter who's in charge of government, that these things can happen again.
If you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest is Sean Kay, an Ohio Wesleyan University professor and also an associate at the OSU Mershon Center for International Security Studies. How critical now is the president's relationship with Defense Secretary Robert Gates? He held him over. Was he wise to keep him on past the Bush presidency at this point? Do you have any observations about that?
Yeah, well, certainly my own personal opinion is that it was a very wise move. It gave it's the kind of job that ought to be, in my opinion, depoliticized. It should be an expert. It should be somebody who's there and serving the Constitution and the interests of the country with the best advice they can give the president. And Robert Gates, over time, has really developed an excellent record providing good advice, good information to the president. I'm particularly impressed right now with Secretary Gates and the senior military leadership have said several times that the number one overall threat to the American economy today is our debt. And they've begun looking at ways to think about cutting the defense budget, which is going to have to happen because we are spending way too much money on defense right now. And we're not getting the same relative influence in the world relative to the size that we're actually spending. It's quite disproportionate, in fact. It's three times as big as it was 15 years ago. 15 years ago, we had more influence in the world than we do today. So he recognizes that. A more interesting question, as interesting a question is, what about the senior military leadership? Because we had the incident with General McChrystal over the summer. And I think that we know that Secretary Gates has said that he did not want to see General McChrystal removed from his job, but the president acted with significant authority in that regard. We had another general say last week from the Marine Corps that it would be that this deadline, the timeline in Afghanistan, is undermining our mission in the war there. That's probably not the kind of comment that should be made in public. That's good military advice if it is good advice, but it ought to be given privately to the Secretary of Defense or privately to the president, but not to the press.
We're going to have to take a break. When we return, we'll get to some calls about the idea of weapons of mass destruction. My guest is Sean Kay. He's a professor at Ohio Wesleyan University. He's also an associate at the OSU Mershon Center for International Security Studies. 614-292-8513 if you want to give us a call, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and contact us there. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Two months from midterm elections that could reshape Washington, the make or break issues seem clear.
Jobs.
The economy.
Healthcare.
Immigration.
I'm Neil Conan. The issues and the stakes. Political junkie Ken Rudin joins us. Plus, as we turn a page in Iraq, Tom Ricks on the best books of the Iraq War. Join us next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation will be here from 2 until 4, right here on WOSU 820, NPR News. 73 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:20 this morning. Sunshine today, another hot one with a high of 92. Clear skies tonight and a low of 67. Sunny tomorrow and a high of 91.
Support for WOSU comes from The Other Paper, Columbus's news and entertainment weekly. On newsstands every Thursday and online at theotherpaper.com.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Sean Kays, a professor of politics at Ohio Wesleyan University and an associate of the Mershon Center for International Security Studies at The Ohio State University. He is also as a NATO expert in 2007 and 2008, was a foreign policy advisor to the Obama presidential campaign. We're going to talk a little bit about weapons of mass destruction with a few callers. Gary, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, good morning. You know, I can't think of how long it's been since the term weapons of mass destruction was thrown out there, but it seems like there's been a feeding frenzy on that terminology. And I'd like to ask your guest, number one, to give me a clear-cut definition of what a weapon of mass destruction is, and then I'm going to have another point for him.
Okay, well, that's a great question. A clear-cut definition of weapon of mass destruction. Well, most experts will tell you, and I would agree with it, that a chemical weapon is not a weapon of mass destruction. Biological weapons can be, but their capacity to be militarized and weaponized into the kinds of things that would kill massive amounts of people is really, really difficult to do. So really when it comes down to it, you're talking about a weapon that could be used to kill very large amounts of people. And the one that is out there in the world that's more plausible and realistic would be the nuclear capability. And we knew before the invasion of Iraq that Iraq had not, as Vice President Cheney said, quote, reconstituted nuclear weapons. We knew that because the International Atomic Energy Agency made that very clear in a report to the United Nations. They had better information, better intelligence than our own government did, and we did not pay attention to that. So, but if you want a very specific definition, that's a long-winded answer, but that's what I'd give you.
Gary?
Well, so I guess you'd be saying to me that if somebody set off a nerve gas attack in New York City and it killed 2 million people, that would not be a weapon of mass destruction?
I just don't see how that could plausibly happen. They could be used for as a weapon of mass terror, and that's a little different. The way that would most likely play out would be in a contained environment like a subway system or something like that. I mean, for example, the anthrax attack. They're very costly to clean up, very scary, did a lot of damage to people's fear, to so forth, and it killed several people. But the real story there was that it was not used as a weapon of mass destruction. It was, and this is how I'd address your comment, a weapon of mass fear, and it was quite effective in that regard. It doesn't make it any less dangerous in that sense, but it's you have to be careful about how we look at the actual capacity to deploy these weapons.
Thanks, Gary, for your call. I appreciate it. Let's see. And then, John, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I once heard the case made that Saddam himself was being misled by his own scientists as to how advanced the weapons program was in order to cover their own tails or save their own necks, and that we may have been misled by the same misinformation that Saddam himself was. I wondered if there was any truth to that.
Yeah, that's a great question also. There's basically – the CIA has done a study on this that they've published, and they've got several – scenarios as to why Saddam Hussein seemed to be not capitulating or agreeing on the weapons and so forth. First of all, it turns out actually he was. And at the end, it was a flurry of effort to cooperate and so forth. But it is a reasonable question. Okay, well, if he didn't have it, why, you know, what did he gain from being obstinate about this, you know, and so forth? And there are several reasons the CIA came up with this, and I'd add one more. The CIA's estimate was, A, that he wanted to have a capacity threat to dissuade local people inside of Iraq from rising up. That had more to do with biological and chemical weapons he might use against people who might overthrow his government. Mm-hmm. The second one was to deter or dissuade Iran from having encroaching interests or maybe even a war with Iraq. And the third one was that his senior officers may have, in fact, been lying to him because they were afraid. They were afraid of what could happen if they found out that they actually didn't have the programs that they said that they were making. One other thing, though, is you got to remember, and this happened in the Clinton administration, that Secretary Albright, Madeleine Albright, Secretary of State, made a comment in the late 1990s that basically we would not lift sanctions on Iraq until Saddam Hussein was gone. That disincentivized him from full cooperation on a wide range of issues. And so, ironically, an effort to bring about regime change that did start initially under the Clinton administration might have actually backfired a little bit in that degree.
Okay. Is it reasonable that these other United Nations agencies had better intelligence than we on this very question, that they were not being fooled where we were being fooled?
That's a really important point. And I've done a paper on this that's going to be published soon. But I've looked in at all the weapons inspections in Iraq from the early 1990s up until the end of this. And here's what the facts are. The weapons inspectors through the United Nations had better information than we did. In fact, the CIA gave these weapons inspectors on the ground their very, very best intelligence information about where these weapon sites they thought were. And they went to these sites between late 2002 and early 2003. And they could not find these things. It turned out that there were discrepancies, but they were largely accounting discrepancies in the dismantling of the chemical and biological weapons program, and the IAEA was able to verify that the nuclear program was eliminated. Now, that said, there is also part of that story that at least has to be considered relative to the assumptions that the Bush administration was making, which is that also in 1992, the UN investigators had found that Iraq was much further along then than our intelligence agencies thought with regard to their nuclear program. But then they decided not to pay attention to the subsequent reports that said that program had been and was being dismantled by the time we invaded Iraq. Now, one last little point about that that's just really crucial in hindsight to think about. The overall cost, according to Hans Blix and the United Nations team, of the weapons inspection team that went back in to Iraq in fall 2002 to eliminate and verify the weapons that we thought were still there, $82 million annual budget versus an invasion of Iraq that has cost right now headed towards $1 trillion and maybe in the end $3 trillion. $82 million combined with a U.S. presence of containment, which costs about $1.2 billion a year, was working. It was working. And so, you know, all we can do is look back in hindsight now, but hopefully, as we were discussing before, learn some of those lessons. And I think those lessons are really important because the IAEA now is giving us very good information about Iran, and they're very credible. And so when they say that Iran is not cooperating on certain kinds of elements of their nuclear program, we do have to listen to them very, very carefully.
Thank you. Do we have time for one more question?
Okay, one more.
How is the oil sharing going? Is that being worked out?
Well, they're working on it. It has not been resolved, and this is part of the larger term puzzle of, okay, we had the surge. It was effective, complementary to some other things happening on the ground, but the surge was supposed to facilitate space in which oil sharing would occur, which the Kurds and the others would get into a political arrangement, and so on. These big ticket items are still not – I mean, they had an election 6 months ago, and they still don't have a government. The oil sharing will take probably a decade to finally resolve. So it's being worked on all right. They have made some strides. But until you get that, you're not going to get a self-funded capacity for Iraq to develop its own economy. And just as we're pulling out, the international community and the money that's been going on to helping the Iraqis is going to start to dry up. And they do not yet have the self-sustained capacity to basically run their economy on their own. So this is one of the larger term strategic problems that could still come back to haunt us over the next, say, 2 to 3 years.
John, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Take care. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU. My guest is Sean Kays, Ohio Wesleyan University professor in international relations and an associate at the OSU Merchant Center for International Security Studies. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're going to turn our attention, as the president did last night, to Afghanistan and the war in Afghanistan. Another deadline. Are deadlines wise these days, Sean?
Great question.
You're saying next, was it July 31st or something like
2011.
That?
2011. That's now that. There's a technical issue here, which is that that is the assumed deadline for the beginning of a drawdown of the 30,000 troops that were surged into Afghanistan earlier this year, which have yet to even fully come into place yet, actually. So we are – the president made a decision almost a year ago now in December that really did commit America to a very, very long war in Afghanistan. It's already gone on longer than Vietnam, longer than World War II. The American public needs to be conditioned for this. But that said, one of the issues of a deadline, it's a reasonable thing for people to criticize the president because he maybe didn't talk about how the surge helped in Iraq and that how it could help in Afghanistan too. But on the other hand, the deadline helped in Iraq too. It put pressure on local people to realize that eventually they can't just be completely dependent on a permanent assistance and presence of the United States, especially our military. And that message has to be sent to Hamid Karzai in particular and the people around him in Afghanistan, that they have to start doing the tough, tough things with regard to corruption, government reform, and so forth in Afghanistan if we have any hope of ever beginning to withdraw. And if by if after 10 years of involvement in Afghanistan, we can't reach a point where we can rely on local governance, I don't know when we can. So the deadline sends a strong message to them. Simultaneously, it recognizes reality that the American public is getting wearier and wearier of these wars. The Afghan war is costing us now about on average will cost $100 billion a year. Our presence in Afghanistan is more than two times the entire economy of the country in terms of how much we're spending and how much it costs.
That'll probably be the best thing to happen to the company now.
What's that?
To the country.
Not really. I mean, this is it's a real problem in the sense that, like, for example, a local person that might otherwise start up a local business or do something to grow the Afghan economy other than like drugs and whatnot, mm-hmm. Make more money working as a translator for American troops or something like that. You know, so they actually – some of their best and brightest people that mm-hmm. could contribute to society uh-huh. get sucked up by these aid agencies and the UN and so forth. But that's a micro-level mm-hmm. problem. The bigger issue is we are going to have to fasten our seatbelts. It's going to be a long, tough haul in Afghanistan. And I very much split with the president over and his advisors over the decision to send more troops into Afghanistan last fall.
You know, you say after 10 years, but is it fair to really use that time frame when the attention put on Afghanistan was distracted so much when they moved into Iraq? Is it 10 years? Are all 10-year periods the same?
Well, it's a long time for a country yeah. that also has other challenges. And if you look at what the director of the National Counterterrorism Center has said, there's at best 50 to 100 al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. So that argument is a tough one. The bigger argument is that if you don't have a stable Afghanistan, then you don't have leverage to keep on Pakistan and India, and then you run into a concern about a broader war around the region if Afghanistan were to collapse. But that, to me, isn't a real persuasive argument as to why Americans should continue to have to sacrifice in this country for another 10 years. We have to be able to come up with something a little more creative than that. But also the looking back, you know, I would argue that candidate Obama was absolutely right when he began in about 2006 saying we needed to surge into Afghanistan and that we needed a new strategy there around counterinsurgency. I supported that at the time. I wrote op-ed pieces. I said specifically we needed 30,000 more troops. The problem is that this time frame has a reality to it, which is that when you're dealing with an insurgency like the Taliban, which was coming back by 2006, we needed to get at them then before they got a foothold in southern Afghanistan. Now they have basically merged with that population in southern Afghanistan. The problem that I had was that I think this was the right policy, but about 3 years too late. And I think that's tragic for America. It's tragic for Afghanistan. But we have to look at the realities of the situation. And when Barack Obama became president, the situation in Afghanistan had deteriorated so much that this concept that they were waiting to put in place and then decided on in fall of 2009 was too late and also too little and based on some very flawed assumptions, in fact, about counterinsurgency itself.
Let's take an email and then we'll take one call before we go to a break. This is from a listener, writes, I find it very difficult to criticize President Obama's speech last night. However, I believe he knew the limits to this one speech and was trying through the speech to bring the country together and to have we Americans be as courageous as the troops who fought, died, and were wounded in Iraq. We now need to face the need for public policies that adequately deal with the many pressing issues before us. So that just kind of goes back to the Iraq discussion.
Well, that's a fair – I'd like to say I actually thought that was the most important line in the speech, that the country itself at this point in time – and this is just a personal observation, but one of the best ways we could honor the troops is to be as creative and innovative and as strong as they were in matching the problems that we confront here at home. And he said that, I thought, very clearly. And that was to me a call for America to really start to think about what can we achieve as a country. But it's no longer a question, I think, of yes, we can. It's more of a question of will we? And until we get our sense of cohesion back into our country, which we lost over the war, which we've lost over politics, it's going to be really hard to grapple with the fundamental challenges like the debt that we have or the joblessness that we have. So, you know, he was making an important point to transition towards the economy and yet at the same time towards a new war, which is going to cost us a lot of money and resources and people in the end.
614-292-8513. And Bill, you're on the air. You want to know if we're kidding ourselves?
Well, not exactly, but without the background. Sean mentioned earlier, after I dialed, actually, about the economy situation in Iraq. How stable will it be? How productive will it be once we pull out? So that just is a plus to what I was going to ask. Afghanistan has always been a fairly poor country, and if we helped them build up their military and their police to actually have the, quote, security they need, will their economy, in both countries, I'll ask now, be able to support that level of internal cost to maintain this kind of a military on their own hook?
Well, that's the real long-term strategic goal in both cases, as the president said last night, which is to get to a point where the people in these countries can take responsibility for their own future. The problem is the assumptions that one would make about Iraq are just simply not applicable to Afghanistan. As a colleague said the other night on another program, it's like comparing apples to bicycles or something. I mean, these are just so fundamentally different. So the idea that we can apply the same concepts there in Afghanistan as we did in Iraq are just flawed. And I would add to that, I would say I want to make sure I get this out. I'm part of a group that's done an Afghan study group that's going to go public on the 8th of September in Washington. But people can read this online now. But we have a group of about 40 top experts on this issue in this country have come together and recommended a new plan forward for Afghanistan based on power sharing, political inclusion, ending military operations in southern Afghanistan, focusing mainly much more on the threat of al-Qaeda and domestic security, and as you rightly say, focusing more on economic development in Afghanistan as a path towards reconciliation rather than war, in effect. And then finally, we've got to do a much better job of engaging the regional powers. I mean, the Russians have experience there. China is sitting back and just not doing a lot here. The one that's most important for me, though, is ending the combat operations in southern Afghanistan immediately, if not as soon as possible. That's just my own opinion. But right now, I think that that is not helping us. It's pushing the Taliban closer to al-Qaeda. It's pushing them over the border into Pakistan. I'm not saying we should withdraw from Afghanistan in any time soon, but we should stop the combat operations, pull back, and focus on stability and economic development and training the army and police in the parts of the country where we can accomplish something. And basically, we need to give that probably about 2 years, in my opinion. But there's a larger report on this. If people are interested, they can look at it online.
Thanks, Bill, for your call.
My question was about the economics.
Well,
for example, could they have, could if we did it just like we would like to do it 2 years from now, will their economy support the defense we've asked them to carry?
No, it won't. And you know, I've seen costs or economic forecasts that say, on the current trajectory, Afghanistan by about 2020 would have an economy about on par with Bangladesh. I mean, it's one of the poorest countries in the world. So, you know, relative expectations at this point, success in Afghanistan to most people would be a stable, self-sufficient country that can stand on its own. Turning it into an economic a success story, turning it into a democracy, those things are really not high on the agenda at this point.
Thanks, Bill, for your call. We're going to have to take another break. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
See the new lineup of public affairs programming on Friday nights from WOSU-TV. Starting at 8 is Washington Week, followed by Columbus on the Record at 8:30. Continuing at 9 is the McLaughlin Group. And at 9:30, PBS presents Need to Know, a new program with an innovative broadcast and web approach to news gathering and reporting. Watch the new public affairs lineup every Friday night beginning at 8 on WOSU-TV.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of the program will be here. And in today's tough economy, we'll hear how to use social media to showcase your talents to potential employers and to find a job. That discussion begins at 11 on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Get the latest information from WOSU the way you want it, daily, biweekly, or monthly. Go to WOSU.org/email, and you can sign up for one of our e-newsletters. And it's 75 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:42 this morning. Sunny skies today, another warm day with a high of 92 degrees. Clear skies tonight and a low right around 67. Sunny for Thursday and a high of 91. Thursday night, there is a slight chance of rain and a low of 67 and a chance of rain on Friday. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Sean Kay, Ohio Wesleyan University professor in international relations and also an associate at the OSU Mershon Center for International Security Studies. We're going to move on to Ireland in a few minutes to talk about what Sean was doing there all summer besides goofing around and posting on Facebook. But first, we'll take a call. It's a caller from Delaware. You want to talk about Iran?
Yes. And I just have a question for your guest. I have heard a lot of politicians say that we should go and attack Iran. And I'm wondering if that is a reasonable idea.
Define reasonable.
Yeah, reasonable. That's where I'm stuck is the reasonable part. You know, attacking Iran at this point would, you know, it's one of those things where, geez, okay, it sounds like you can do something relatively simply. But let's say even if you just accept the proposition that we should, you'd have to ask several things. But what can you accomplish for one thing? We do know that the Iranian nuclear program is spread out around at least 13 or so different sites. It would be very hard to do anything other than set it back. And then you got to ask yourself what happens on day two and beyond of that war, because it seems really unlikely that Iran would just sit back and do nothing. And so we'd have to be prepared for very substantial spikes in the price of gasoline, for example. It would be a profound impact on the global economy if that war went on. But the actual how you would do it is if you really dig into the military capacity of it, it would be really tough. The more dangerous question is not whether we would do it, but whether Israel might just decide on its own that they're going to go do it. And that would create a really big dilemma for the United States. But whether it should happen, I certainly, in my own personal view, think the relative costs would not outweigh the benefits at this point in time. Their missile ranges are very underdeveloped. Their nuclear program is still, according to the CIA and other agencies that we can rely on, is still some distance away. But also, they're relatively weak militarily, and this is a country that arguably can be contained and boxed in. The real question is the internal dynamic in Iran. What's going to happen with the Iranian people, the Iranian political system, and so forth? So it's very hard to know even, you know, about how to go about negotiating with a country like that so long as there's so much potential internal turmoil. But the best case would be to try to figure out the diplomacy to get Iran to a situation where they decide wisely, I would argue, that it's not in their interest to get a weapon. One last point, though, I want to make on this quickly is that the danger really to me is not that Iran would have the weapon, although I think it would be a bad thing personally. The real danger is once they have it, there's just as much danger then that the Saudis would want it, the Syrians would want it, the Turks would want it, and that could create a significant sort of off to the races of nuclear proliferation in the heart of a pivotal part of the world. And that's why the stakes are so high at this stage. That's what we really have to make sure does not happen.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Take care. 614-292-8513. My guest is Sean Kay. He is a professor at Ohio Wesleyan University in International Relations. He spent the summer in Ireland, and you're writing a book about the political and economic situation there, and I guess why now, and was it just a great time to travel to Ireland? It's kind of tough there right now.
Well, I've been going to Ireland for about 25 years, and I've published a lot and written a lot on big issues of war and peace and so forth, and I was kind of ready for something a little bit more micro level, I guess. But the short answer to your question is I think that Ireland itself is really interesting in a bigger picture for three key reasons. One is which that it was quickly the most globalized economy in the world. They had rapid economic growth. Ireland, as an example, during what they called the Celtic Tiger, was central to Tom Friedman's thesis about the benefits of globalization. He wrote in 2005 about how he gets a lump in his throat when he thinks about little countries like Ireland becoming so globalized and doing such wonderful things. Since 2005, last year they had about negative 13% economic growth. They have about 14% unemployment today. Their debt to GDP ratio is about 113%. They're, I think, right now the largest per capita debtor country in the world. Per capita debt in Ireland is about $37,000. That's just personal share of the public debt. There's one bank in particular there that's gone completely kaputs. The government's spending about 22% of the economy on this one bank called Anglo-Irish. So they've gone just in a very short space of time from this dramatic economic success story. John McCain in the election in 2008 said America should model itself on Ireland. And I in a debate, and I remember thinking at the time, no, this is probably not where
things were starting to unravel.
That's when it was unraveling.
Yeah,
so the banks were going under. There's no money in the banks there right now. They don't know how much is missing. The government has had to make massive public sector cuts in spending. They're a country that is just so it's interesting at that level, like, how does globalization treat a society like that? You know, and so when they rise so fast and so successfully and then fall so fast as well. But I've also been much more interested in what are the positive changes that have come on. You're looking at a country that, for example, while I was there, I watched debates in the parliament and they voted to pass for the whole country civil partnership law. They are more progressive on gay rights in Ireland than we are in this country. I thought that was an interesting change. Mm-hmm. They've become very multicultural. They have people from all around the world living there now. That creates a whole new opportunity for human capital for the future, which is a major change from 20 years ago.
Well, is that a major change in the influence of the church there?
The church is a significant issue because as one politician I met with called Rory Quinn a Labor Party leader, he former finance minister. He said, we've been a post-Catholic country for about 20 years now, actually. But it's really become rough now because of the scandals in the church that have gone on with the child abuse. And and protection of children and so forth becomes a real issue. But yet it's still – so we have an image in America of Ireland as this sort of conservative Catholic society, but that's really not true. It's not reality anymore. So that's changed dramatically. And the third big thing that I'd say has changed is, of course, what's happened in Northern Ireland and with the peace process there. And that creates tremendous opportunity, but there are also some significant challenges, which I saw myself on the streets in Ardoyne in Belfast in July, just after a bunch of riots had been going on for several nights. And I'd be glad to talk about that more if you like.
Sure. Well, let's talk about that. What's happening? Because sometimes it's hard to understand. You mentioned there's a lot of – the economics have a lot to do with it. There's just a lot of poor people, a lot of kids with nothing to do.
Yeah.
Same problems we have here.
Exactly. And I was concerned when I was there because I was watching CNN and a few other global news networks that were portraying riots in Belfast, which had been sparked ostensibly by Orange Order Protestants marching, which happens every time, every year around that time. Mm-hmm. It's something they've been doing. It gets a little in your face to local Catholic groups for sure. It can be a front. But the riots that were happening, and they were serious. There was a policewoman that was hit with a brick and seriously injured.
Yeah.
And these were young Catholic people in Ardoyne in particular, but other parts of Belfast as well, who went out. But they rioted well after the parades were gone. And they were basically, if you looked at the pictures, they were 8 to 10-year-old kids. Now, there were dissident IRA people that were involved in stoking some of this. But the real story that I thought was so crucial is that, you know, we've had over 10 years of a peace process there now. And I think this is a really crucial lesson for these broader issues we were talking about earlier too. When you think about Iraq, they've had 30 years of war, right? Afghanistan too. Northern Ireland, decades of conflict, right? But now you have a young generation. If you're 10 to 12 to 15 to 18 years old now, you wouldn't know the horrors necessarily of what went on in places around Northern Ireland. And so what's happened now is that you have – when the peace process thankfully took place, it's worked really well at the top levels. The senior levels of government are cooperating. They're working. They have new police. That's a national police force that is coming together. It has political support and so forth. But it's at this street-to-street level, both for Protestants and Catholics, that I got very concerned about, because the American involvement so far right now at this point is mostly about economics at the high end. What can we do to get foreign direct investment? I just don't see a sustained effort to reach out to these next generation of people who don't know what the bad days were really like, but most importantly have literally no sense of a future. And one last point I'd like to say really quick. When it's an irony of the peace process, but they used to have summary justice in these areas for Protestant paramilitaries or the IRA. If a young person or anyone made a criminal act, they were the police. They came in and enforced their own law. That's gone now. But the police can't go in because it's too dangerous for them. And so you have these young people. It's a whole lost generation of both Catholics and Protestants who don't see the benefits of peace. And that could be true also in the Middle East.
Right.
It could be true in Afghanistan. It could be true in Iraq. And that worries me, because that's the place where you really do need the investment in people's future. And it's not happening today.
And you mean another point that they don't have the role models. And when you were talking about that, or when you wrote about that, the idea that they don't have role models, I wasn't quite sure what you meant by that. Is it that their parents still haven't resolved their conflicts because that process didn't get down to that street-to-street level?
Yeah, well, that's true. But I really want to say that these same problems that I saw on the streets in Belfast and also in Derry when I was up in there, less so in Derry actually, but these are the same problems we see in Baltimore and Philadelphia.
Right.
It's just it gets labeled with a political ideology, which has nothing to do with what's really going on. It really is economic. And especially in Belfast, it's about drugs primarily, drug crime, drug violence. So you could watch a show like The Wire and just replace it with Belfast and you get the same thing. That's one thing I was concerned about when I wrote an article for The Washington Note, that the imagery shouldn't be that this is falling apart, the peace process is falling apart. What's happening is local law and order is not taking root. But over the long term, that is where it could fall apart if you don't find a way to give young people there a sense of a future, because then they can get manipulated by these former dissidents who have no legitimacy, who simply want to have more violence. That will erode this process over time.
There's often conflict over which flag you're flying in Ireland.
Yeah.
Has anyone ever thought about creating a new flag for Ireland?
It's fascinating. The flags become very symbolic in the north,
yeah.
not in the Republic,
okay.
of course. And the flag itself, the green and the orange and the white in between, is meant to symbolize, you know, the capacity for these religions to get together. But you do see the union flag, unionists. I mean, you know when a house is a unionist house. But one thing that's fascinating in some of the most Catholic rough areas of Belfast that I was in, you might see symbolism on a house that says, you know, we're nationalists, we're Catholic, whatever. But you could also look a little more closely and you would see I'm also a Manchester United supporter for soccer.
Sports, or something, the great unite.
So, yeah, exactly. And a Protestant house would have the same thing. The problem is for these young people when so their parents are, you know, struggling themselves. They're not involved at the local level like they should be. The churches aren't involved like they used to be, and the political leadership has a difficult time reaching out to them. So the role model that a local kid, now literally this is on a street to street basis at mm-hmm. a very micro level. Because you can walk up a few more blocks and be in mixed areas where Catholic and Protestants are getting along great. The old areas, what are called the Falls Road and the Shankill area, there hasn't been violence there in 10 years. So it's working more or less. But there's this sort of bottom-up lost generation who don't see their parents going off to work every day. What they do see is the drug thug on a corner who has all the, you know, sort of standing in the local community and so forth. And to want to be like him might be ambitious for these young people today. Again, it's a very small part of society. And most all of it's in public housing in Belfast. And so you don't have integrated public housing. There isn't even a political interest in having it because that would erode some of the base for some of the political parties that exist up there. But at the end of the day, you have a situation where peace is working. We brought in former terrorists, the IRA. We negotiated with them. You know, we often have this thing where you don't negotiate with terrorists. Well, the British did, we did, and it worked. We brought them in. We got a political settlement. It's working. But again, my concern, especially from American policy point of view, mm-hmm. is that the place where we ought to be most concerned is in this one little area. By the way, about the flags, I have to say, in a lot of the hardcore Protestant unionist areas, they fly Israeli flags as well as their own Union Jack flags because they see themselves as surrounded by enemies and sort of lost in that sense.
That's all the time we have. I hope you can come back and join us and talk to us more about Ireland.
Maybe it's St. Patrick's Day.
Maybe it's St. Patrick's Day. Good idea. And also we'll put a link to that report that you mentioned from the Afghanistan Study Group. It's called A New Way Forward, Rethinking U.S. Strategy in Afghanistan. We'll have that on our website. I want to thank Sean Kay for joining us today, Ohio Wesleyan University Professor of International Relations.
Thank you.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.